Welcome to Crime Time, a Virginia criminal law podcast. I'm here with Anna Dvorak, Anthony Norse, and Ann Thayer. Enjoy the show.
So here it is, legal disclaimer, because we are lawyers and we've got to write one. So if you are listening to this podcast, thank you. We sincerely hope you are listening to this podcast for its entertainment value and not with the intention of acquiring legal advice for any individual case or situation. I mean, come on, you wouldn't take advice from someone you have never met or spoken to directly, right? If you were bleeding profusely, you wouldn't listen to a podcast in hopes of a bandage somehow materializing over the internet and onto your 3D printer. Seeking actual legal advice can be just as important as a tourniquet. The hosts of this podcast are in no way intending to create an attorney-client relationship with any listener. Sorry, we are sure you all are great people, but we cannot stress enough how little we know of you and your case. And rather than risk an awkward moment, let us just remember we have never met. Nothing on this platform should be taken as legal advice for any individual case or situation. We are just a group of friends with differing opinions and viewpoints, which we will try to explore through discussions of current events, law changes, and whatever else floats our fancy.
Who likes to rock the party?
Alberto Salvato here. I am sad to report that I will be off for about 3 or 4 weeks, hopefully only 3 or 4 weeks. Apparently, they discovered that all my bad jokes have been coming from a brain tumor. When I come back, my jokes will be better, and you won't be subjected to listening to these terrible podcasters who are filling in for me. Please make them feel better and listen on. Give them a chance. They may not be as funny as I am, but they have good hearts.
Alberto's talking about himself again.
In today's episode, we're lucky to have join us two awesome Pittsburgh Penguin fans.
No. No.
I couldn't do it with a straight face. All right, I'll do it for real. All right.
That's slanderous.
It is. It's defamation. I'll represent you.
In today's episode, we're lucky to have two fantastic attorneys join us. I've known them for a long time. I used to have office space with them, and they are joining us tonight to talk about sentencing. We're going to have two different episodes, one of which is we're going to deal with federal sentencing, making a federal case out of your sentencing. Our second episode is going to be I've been found guilty. Now what happens to me? So tonight, let's welcome Tom Walsh and Mark Petrovich. And will you guys please introduce yourself and tell our listeners a little bit about what you guys do? And
okay, my name is Tom Walsh from the firm of Petrovich and Walsh. And Mark and I have been together since 1994. We've litigated a lot of cases. We handled both state and federal cases and handled everything from simple traffic matters up to capital murders. But my focus tonight is going to be on federal cases, more importantly, sentencing, because that's where it mainly resolves. And that's where the rubber hits the road. And Mark?
My name is Mark Petrovich. I'm the Petrovich and Petrovich and Walsh. Tom and I have been together a long time, and we've been doing this type of work out of a passion, really, for a long time. We handle a lot of different types of cases, all types of criminal defense cases, and we do handle a lot of federal cases as well. We can speak from experience with regard to federal trials, but also with regard to federal sentencings, and we can compare those to the state court sentencings and note the differences between the two.
We're very excited to have you guys on here, and because you're very experienced lawyers, you're funny and you're very smart, so let's get started.
Should we be funny during this broadcast?
Alberta,
no, you should not be funny at all. Never be funny.
No, you can definitely be funny.
Nope, we're very serious at all times.
All right, just making sure.
And we have a new Alberto. No, just kidding.
I'll take that title with honor.
Yeah.
So you try to tell jokes and we make fun of you, and Anna yells at you.
And that's Alberto's role.
I've suffered through worse treatment than that, believe me.
How should we start this episode out? You guys practice in the federal courts and the state courts, and there's some big differences there. So what do you think listeners should know about federal court once you're being sentenced, and what things go into how a judge is going to sentence you and what they're going to consider when they're doing that?
I'll start off. So basically in federal court, it's mitigation a lot of times. The government has seized the day. They've investigated for years or months, and they've decided to indict you on various things, and you want to mitigate your exposure. There's the sentencing guidelines that require the judge to consider a certain scale. It's a criminal history and it's a point based on the offense. And what happens is they run the guidelines, they being the probation, and it comes down to a certain number of months or years that you're going to end up doing. The defense attorney's job is to minimize that and try to argue against and show that the judge should not file the guidelines since 2005 Booker, the United States Booker case, where basically they said the guidelines are unconstitutional as mandatory. And so what happens is you try to show that your client should be sentenced below the guidelines and you bring in all mitigation you can. And so that's how basically the case on sentencing in federal court goes. Now, there's various other things. 3553 is a code section that allows you to introduce numerous other things. The circumstances of the case, the person's background, any mitigation. And so there you go and you basically argue those things, put them in the sentencing memorandum and try to argue to the judge that the guidelines are not mandatory, or not mandatory, but not should be filed, and then should go below.
What sorts of mitigation do you actually try to present to the judge to get below the guidelines?
So yeah, there's numerous factors under that. It's basically the circumstances of the case, the education of the person, the background of the person, how they're raised, any other, if there's violence involved, was a gun involved, not involved, and then any other circumstances like character letters, character references that will allow you to show that this person deviated from the normal course of action, a normal behavior, and was caught up in something that they shouldn't.
Do the federal cases consider mental illness as well? I know the state courts consider mental illness quite a bit, but I'm not certain about the federal courts. How do they address mental illness?
Well, that's a great question. They do address mental illness. That carries the day. I mean, it does, not all the way, but it's one of the factors that is involved that it's been overlooked for years, but now it's coming to head. It's basically that they understand mental health illness now. And now that they can get out from under Booker in 2005, where they're not required to file the guidelines as a mandatory sentencing, they can, in turn, look at these factors of physical abuse, mental abuse, bipolar, schizophrenic, and they can adjust the sentence to accommodate the defendant.
So the mental health, is there a particular statute that addresses mental health? I mean, are you allowed, do you often put doctors on in mitigation? I mean, is that what you see when you're trying to prove there's a diminished either capacity or role for the person, or they weren't quite aware of what they're doing? Because what, you know, we see a lot of mental health cases in state court, but we always talk about there are types of crimes that lend themselves to mental health conditions like trespassing, assault and battery, petty larceny, certainly things, you know, panhandling, things that you see all the time in state court, but you don't see those in federal court. In federal court cases, are they go after bigger cases. They focus their resources on other things. So I'm assuming that.
Yeah, that's 100% correct. I mean, so when you present mental health in state court on those cases, trespass, destruction of property, assault and battery, those are misdemeanors. Usually when you get in federal court, they're cranking up on a felony. It's not often you get, like, unless it's a traffic violation or something really petty, it's going to be a felony. So what happens is the 3553 takes in consideration those things, which you need to put in front of the judge. And what you'll do is you'll get those documents together and you'll present them in a seal. You'll seal them because it's client information, mental health, HIPAA, and you'll present that to them and then under seal in a sentencing memorandum. 9 times out of 10, the judge will take you as an officer of the court, your word, and not have to put the person on the stand. I have had to put people on the stand in sex cases to have the judge question them as to their report, as the recidivism, but generally not. You don't have to establish it with witnesses. You can do it in a report with a sentencing memorandum.
Yeah, it's very unusual to have testimony during a federal sentencing, particularly with regard to mental health. That's a factor, one of the factors, the personal background and circumstances of the defendant that you want to get the judge to consider. There are a couple other ones. Tom mentioned 3553. That's the overarching statutory authority. So in federal court, the judge is first directed to consider the guidelines. But as Tom noted, since Booker, the guidelines have become discretionary. So the judge then imposes a sentence he or she feels is appropriate under the specific circumstances. And the statute directs them to consider these other factors, which include mental health issues. They include perhaps a horrible situation during their childhood, perhaps a terrible situation that arose when they became adult that preceded the circumstances of the crime. Perhaps, and we see this very often because many federal cases are based on drug conspiracies, addiction. The mental health issues often become addiction, and the judges will take that into account. It's a compassionate and sympathetic factor that they'll consider. One of the other factors, since many of the cases in federal court are conspiracies, is they are directed by 3553 to avoid disparity in sentencing, which means they're supposed to sentence similar defendants somewhat similarly. So if you have a co-defendant that's been sentenced, or it's a fairly big conspiracy, and there have been a number of other sentences imposed that are relatively low, then you can point that out and the judge will listen to those. I had a case very recently where the judge took that into account substantially because the co-defendants received lighter sentence. And even though the prosecutor wanted more time, the judge acknowledged that these other co-defendants didn't get more, and my client wasn't any more responsible, so why should he serve more time? So all those things are part of the discretionary analysis that the judge now goes through in federal court.
For the disparity issue, is it limited to co-defendants, or can you show other similar cases, not necessarily related to yours, but similar circumstances to yours, and show what the sentences were for those defendants?
You definitely can. You definitely can. And I've done that before. And it comes back to sex offender cases, where the judge imposes substantial amount of probation time, or what is probation time. And so I've had judges imposed 20 years, where other judges have only imposed 5 or 3 years. And so you can take that into account to make sure that it's as Mark said, that defendants are being sentenced the same way instead of somebody going off. So you can definitely present that. I've done it before. And Mark and I did it recently. Well, recently, 2 years, 3 years ago, a lot of cocaine coming out of Colombia. And we tried to make sure that our client was trying to sentence the same way as the leaders, more involved than our client.
One of the fabulous hosts of this podcast, Tony Norse, also known as T-Pain, Ice-T, T-Rex, he and I had a case, and we did exactly that in the sentencing memo. Tom had been talking about sentencing memos, how you're always going to file those in federal court. And we went and did a lot of research on similarly situated defendants in other cases and tried to find some parallels. I think we compared, what would you say, Tony, about 10 cases, right?
I think so, yep. And we tracked down cases with the same judge, in fact, I think.
With the same judge. That's with Ice-T's mastering of the data and the manipulation thereof.
And the PACER system, I assume.
Yes,
exactly.
Good PACER call. PACER and Lexapro.
Good call. Good call.
Let's just type this in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, you know, we were talking about conspiracies, and one of the interesting things that I had a question about, I think it's interesting because I have a question about it, is that when there's conspiracies, you have sort of the low man on the totem pole. And actually, there's times when people get wrapped up where like, well, I just drove my friend to this house. I didn't know anything was going on, and they get charged with the conspiracy. I kind of think of Jamal Lewis. I don't know if you remember the running back from the Ravens.
I remember Jamal Lewis.
And he got like 4 months in a conspiracy case, and he really was a very peripheral actor. And what happens when somebody like that, who doesn't have anyone to give up, you know, no way to give substantial assistance, but doesn't feel like he's done anything wrong, goes to trial, and everybody else flips on everybody else and says Jamal knew enough to know he was in a conspiracy. And so he goes to trial. Maybe there's some sort of mandatory minimum. What happens with sentencing disparity there?
Well, he's the low man on the totem pole. So that's what you argue. You say he's a collateral player in this alleged conspiracy. Their guidelines do recognize a minor role in the offense, and they reduce the guidelines substantially if you qualify for that. But as we said, the guidelines are discretionary anyway. So you argue that. And then you also point out the fact that he did very little, even if he was found to have done something, he did very little. He wasn't a major player. If there's a mandatory minimum, there are these safety valve provisions. So if you have no criminal record and what you did didn't involve any violence, and you come clean with your involvement, there are a couple other factors to consider, but you can qualify for a safety valve consideration, both statutorily under 3553 and in the guidelines, either or both. and you can get below the mandatory minimum, which normally you cannot get below unless you cooperate and provide the government assistance in apprehending and prosecuting other individuals. So
there wouldn't be any trial penalty at all? Like let's say Jamal Lewis went to trial, like would he be able to, you know, do anything with a safety valve since he wouldn't be coming clean?
Well, constitutionally, there shouldn't be any trial penalty, but there is something in federal court where you get 2 points for, now no one can see this, but I'm air quoting, acceptance of responsibility, and you get 2 points off your guideline-based offense level. So you get some credit on the guidelines for accepting responsibility. So it's rewarding those who accept responsibility. It's not punishing those who go to trial, although I guess you could argue it does. But again, the guidelines are discretionary. So does it really have that big an impact?
I mean, is it not like, as in a sense, it's discretionary, but in reality, it does have a big impact if you go to trial, depending on the judge that you have. I think we've all had the experience where
I think that's the same as state court. I mean, if you go to trial, if your client doesn't testify, then there's no way the judge can conclude that he or she is not telling the truth, is not lying. Then there probably won't be a penalty for going to trial. I think the judges in federal court as much, or maybe even a little bit more respect, you know, trying the case. I don't think they hold that against the client. There may be circumstances, you know, every case is different. So there may be some circumstances, some cases where the judge gives somebody a little bit more credit about owning up and accepting responsibility. But for the most part, I think they're pretty fair and not holding that against anybody. I think that's the case. Wouldn't you say that to be true, Tom?
I agree. And it's funny you say Jamal Lewis, because I had a case with Max Richardson who represented him. And Jamal was, like you said, a minor player. And Max out of Atlanta is an amazing attorney. And we worked another case up.
Jamal Lewis was a minor player in the conspiracy, not on the field.
No, he was a good running back.
Yeah, so Max did a great job on that. And I agree with that, that it was a minor thing. What was that?
I think Anne was making some. Was that Anne? Mm-hmm. She is not like the Ravens.
Well, you don't have
no Ravens.
So anyway, yeah. So I agree with Mark.
It's just interesting because you hear a lot about, you know, how much time you can get in federal court. I'm glad to hear that there seems to be more leeway now that.
So and let's talk about that. That's 100% right. So the Clinton administration, coming through in the 90s, did this mandatory guidelines. It started in the end of the 80s. It was devastating to basically kind of discriminate, because a lot of the people that were coming through on the drug charges were African-American people or minorities. You know, you look at a person and you're like, yeah, you picked that suitcase up at the airport. You got paid $500. You're 18. You walked it out to a car. And you're part of the conspiracy with all this weight of drugs. And now you have to go to jail for, you know, minimum 10, 13, mm-hmm. 15 years. And the issue was, but I didn't know what was in, doesn't matter. Because what would happen is you knew there was something in there that was not right. And it was reasonably foreseeable that you knew that. And thank God for, as Mark and I discussed, Booker coming through in 2005. And that was not just one case. It was a movement by the federal public defenders to get this thing overturned, because judges were looking at people going, I have to give you this because Congress made me give you this. And it was just terrible. And now that they're after that, when we started doing sentences, most judges were scared to they weren't used to flexing their wings. Now, as we go forward, they have more discretion. They feel they have more discretion. So they can minimize, they can mitigate, they can go below the guidelines. They can get a 5K1 or a Rule 35 and really cut it down. When the government says, I want 25% off, and Mark and I come in and we want 50% off, and they're giving us 45% off a sentence when the guy was supposed to go away for 10 years. I agree. The system's working now more than it's going better.
That's how it should be. But there shouldn't be a one size fits all. Like, it should always come down to the individual facts.
But let's talk about that. So what happened was, then after Booker came down, Congress decided to put in the statutes, law-wise, mandatory minimums. So you got the 924Cs, which were always there. But you got the other code sections where now, like the sex offenders, like possession, production, or distribution of child pornography. And the judge doesn't have the discretion. Even though the person might be 19 years old, the judge has to give 10 years. And because Congress put it into the statute.
There have been changes recently, though, legislatively, to move the pendulum a little bit back toward a little bit more pro defense. One example is I mentioned earlier, the First Step Act, that was just a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
The Kim Kardashian Act.
That addressed sentencing. That's right, the Kim Kardashian Act. That addressed sentencing.
That kills me.
In some cases, early release. But with regard to other changes, a number of years ago, the legislature started addressing the disparity between crack and powder cocaine.
You're right.
George Bush Sr. came down and made a big issue about this crack dealer in downtown D.C. back when he was president. From that point on, crack was an evil source and treated.
Was that Rafael Edmonds when he was president?
Yes, it was Rafael Edmonds. That's correct. That's what it was.
That's right. That's what I'm sorry.
And since that time, well, after that time, then everything, if you looked at the crack guidelines, you looked at all the crack sentencings, they were outrageously disproportionate to powder cocaine convictions and sentences for the same type of offenses.
During the mandatory guidelines.
Yeah. And that's been addressed a little bit, actually substantially, that's been addressed in the last few years. So things are moving a little bit better now and seem to be going in the right direction from our perspective, trying to make things a little more compassionate. You had a whole generation that lost fathers due to drug offenses that were outrageous sentences that really were disproportionate to what they did. And that's finally being reviewed, adjusted, and addressed.
Well, and isn't that a big difference in the federal and state system where you could get a big sentence in state court, but a lot of times they kind of give you a chance initially, give you your time, and then they put a lot of time over your head for more serious things. And if you mess up, then you're getting that stuff back. How does that work in the federal system?
Well, let's switch over. That's a good question. So the federal doesn't, state will sentence you to a max, let's just say 20 years, and they'll suspend 10 years. And they hold over your head and put you on probation for 5 years, whatever it is. Feds don't do that. The federal court doesn't do that. What they do is they give you the sentence in the code, in the sentencing guidelines. There's basically certain classes, A, B, and C. And it tells them how much time you're supposed to be on supervised release. Supervised release is basically suspended time as compared to the state. So what happens is they put you on 3 years supervised release. That's basically 3 years hanging over your head. If you violate, test dirty urine, or don't report, whatever it is, then they can impose some of that time. If they impose, say you have 3 years and they impose 6 months, now you only have 2 years and 2.5 years hanging over your head. And it works down from that. But that's the extent of it. But they also can come in on a probation violation and reimpose the sentence. But state court gives you 20 years and suspends 10. That's the 10 hanging in your head.
Is the good behavior time similar in federal compared to what the state court does?
It 85%, right?
Yeah. That's right.
Well, I mean, the length of time someone could be like have good behavior where that's hanging over their head that they are subject to that time.
That's not a thing.
Mark's right. It's not a thing. But what you can do is, and probation officers support you on this, if the client has done so well, the probation officer won't do it, but they encourage you to petition the court to end the probation.
You can do that in state court too.
Right.
Yeah. Often it's done when half the time is up and people are doing well on probation.
The halfway point is the marker when you start considering it, usually. That's usually the barometer.
The federal sentencing, I mean, that you hear about, I mean, obviously, we're also talking about charges that are just so much more voluminous. Like, you're not going to have, like, somebody with a little dime bag or a small amount of cocaine in a federal court generally. You're going to have, like, kilos, right? I mean, you're not looking at quantities that are just, they're sort of low-level junkie.
Federal court has the advantage. Prosecutors, the enforcement side in federal court has a tremendous advantage. It was provided to them in the form of the conspiracy law. They can bring charges for these conspiracies. And when you go to trial in federal court, the conspiracy law allows them to bring in basically whatever hearsay evidence they want. because as long as it's in furtherance of the conspiracy, no matter who said it, or no matter who heard who said it, or no matter who didn't hear who said it, it comes in because it's in furtherance of the conspiracy. So they have a huge advantage in trying these cases and in going forward with these charges. And so they sweep when, and the other aspect of conspiracy law now, how it's evolved, is they rely substantially in their enforcement on information they receive from co-conspirators and people who end up cooperating and talking to them. Without those people, they don't get nearly as much action and don't get nearly as many people swept into the conspiracy. So when you combine those two things, they have a huge advantage, and they'll sweep everybody up to get information about the big people up top. So you can get people in federal court that haven't done a whole lot, but the case is really serious and the potential sentence is really high because they're part of this. And again, no one can see this, but I'm air quoting conspiracy. And that's how they prosecute. And it really puts the defendants and the defense attorneys at a huge disadvantage.
So I can't let this go, but Tom Thog says snitches get stitches because he said that he barked when you guys were talking about getting credit and cooperation.
I know. It's sorry about that. I think it's funny.
I think it was awesome.
It's Tom's enforcement dog.
Actually, it's a canine search. Like, we didn't know, but he was being searched right now, and there's a canine.
They just saw
no one can see this.
They just hauled ass downstairs. But in addition to that, I mean, it's Mark's right. But what happens is, and I've seen this over and over time, what the government will do, and it sucks, is they will see there's a conspiracy, and it's a small conspiracy, and they'll leave it out there. I've had cases where they allow the cocaine to come from New York to D.C. or D.C. to New York for a year and a half to 2 years. And what they did is they just wanted to accumulate weight, because weight means more jail time. They're like, well, we'll run, see where it's going. That's bullshit. They knew where it was going. And they
they do that in state court too, though.
Yeah, but in fairness, they do, but not to the extent of feds, because what happens in feds is like the weight, you know, that the weight is the guidelines. It's 2D1.1. They're going to add more. And then they step in. But you know what they're doing? They're allowing drugs go on the street. And it's not good. And then they, like you said, air quotes, they do the conspiracy. And so the one dude that drove the car, did whatever, is linked into, and it's reasonably foreseeable. They apply a fair amount of weight to the guy, and the guy didn't know it, or the girl didn't know it. It's just not good.
Well, I also think that they do that with child porn. It's like they've tagged all these images on the internet that are child pornography. And we all joke the internet's forever, but you can take those off. You can delete them. They can destroy them. They say every time something's downloaded, somebody, you know, we're victimizing a new victim. I was like, well, get rid of them. But though they leave them tagged and they just wait for people to download them.
Images that go on and on and on and on and on.
Right.
And that's knick-knick. And the issue becomes, I don't know if they can actually get them totally off, because if they're downloading the hard drives or downloading the thumb drives, they can't attach them because they're sitting on a desk. If a hard drive is sitting on the desk, they can't get that image. But
yeah, that's a question for Tony Norris.
I think they're making it really accessible for people. I think that, you know, it's like if you take them off, it's making it harder. Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, no, I agree. And so Tony Norris has got some say about this.
Yes, let's hear it.
Tony, do I need to put them in timeout?
You're an engineer by degree. I know that.
I am, yes.
And?
The first rule of the podcast is you don't ask Tony questions.
Well, Tony, just remember, Anna's always right. So what I said, if you could just back that up.
That is what Anna said is right.
That's hilarious.
But it's all Tony's fault, right? According to
it's all Tony's fault.
By now, that goes without saying.
So what else should listeners know about the federal system?
Avoid it.
So one thing you guys mentioned before was Rule 35. And so I'm wondering if you can talk about that a little bit.
So Rule 35 is the mechanism by which the government reduces the sentence of an individual who has cooperated with them and provided them substantial assistance in the enforcement and cooperation against other defendants or other individuals. So the Rule 35 is brought after the sentencing. Our clients would receive a sentence, let's say it's 10 years. If they've cooperated, even if they've cooperated already, the government waits to see what kind of fruit they can develop from the seeds your client has helped plant. And then they decide when to bring the motion. Usually it's within a year, but sometimes it drifts beyond that. And then, so after the client's been sentenced, they bring a motion post-sentencing in front of the judge, the same judge, and describe all the cooperation your client provided, everything he's done, all it's led to, all the positive aspects of it. And then they generously recommend, you know, 35 or 40% reduction. Other jurisdictions, of course, sometimes go up to 70 and 80%, but that's okay. And then we argue for 60%, and then the judge usually provides a 40%, 50% reduction. So you walk out of there with a 5 to 6 year sentence instead of a 10 year sentence. And that's after the fact. That's as opposed to the Rule 5K motion, which is before sentencing. But the Eastern District of Virginia usually doesn't use the pre-sentencing mechanism. They like to rely on the post-sentencing mechanism. They like to get their sentences in place and then reduce them. I think it gives them a touch more leverage.
I agree. So Mark was right. So you have the 5K.
Hold on. He wants to hear you say that one more time.
I hear dogs. So let me say this. Mark was right on that. So you got a 5K1, what happens at sentencing? And 5K1 is in the sentencing, the federal sentencing guidelines, which allows you to reduce a sentence at sentencing. And Mark was right. Very rarely, what happens, they'll file that because it's usually a very limited conspiracy where there may be two or three players and the person cooperated in the beginning, which led to the second person pleading guilty, agreeing to a sentence, pleading guilty or whatever. And so that reduces the sentence. That same mechanism is also called a Rule 35, which is in the federal rules. And so the Rule 35 allows the prosecutor to come into court, and it's comparable to what the state has, which is called a motion to reconsider. And so basically the judge sentences, and then down the road a ways, and Rule 35 statutorily is supposed to be within a year, but there's extensions and everything else like that. So it could be 2 or 3 years out. Your client has gone down the river, the statement is, basically has gone to federal prison. And then the prosecutor files a Rule 35, which basically allows you to get back in court. You cannot file a motion to reconsider a sentence. Defense attorneys don't have the mechanism. But once that Rule 35 is filed, it's a ticket to the dance. It allows you to come in. And as Mark said, they may ask for 25 or 30%, or as he said, some of the jurisdictions, which I wish I knew this jurisdiction, maybe 50%. But long and short is, once they file that motion to reduce a sentence, it allows the defense attorney to come in. We as defense attorneys come in and we shoot high. No, not 25%, 70% off the sentence. And then and argue it with all our additional mitigation, all the certificates that have happened in jail, all the other things. Maybe the person had a child that was born when they were in jail. Maybe parents have gotten sick, whatever it is. Mental health issues, and allows us to reduce the sentence more. So both a 5K1 and a Rule 35 are both mechanisms to allow you to reduce a sentence that sometimes the judge is required under mandatory minimums. For instance, drug weight, it's a mandatory minimum 10, I mean, or something like that. So you can try to get around those and other sentences. But as in state court, you can file a motion to reconsider at any time, and you don't need the blessing from the prosecutor. In federal court, you need the blessing from the prosecutor. You need them to file that motion.
Well, there is one thing in state court in 2019, they passed legislation that is not as known, but it's a little different than a motion to reconsider in the sense that, you know, it specifically allows the case to get back in front of the judge after they're out of the rest of the court.
That's 6 months, right?
State court passed the same kind of legislation Virginia passed the same kind of legislation in 2019. There's the equivalent in state court now. If you have a client that has cooperated in some way, you can get the prosecutor to bring the equivalent of a
rule. I thought that passed in 2021.
It's been at least since 2020.
Even if it passed, but you have to have the prosecutor bring it.
Right.
You still have to have the prosecutor do it. That's right.
What I'm trying to say is motion reconsiders in the state court, minus that statute, you can file it yourself without the blessing. In federal court, you cannot do that. You have to have the ticket to the dance.
So I think the state court statute that you guys are talking about is 19.2303.01. And I think that does require the Commonwealth to bring the motion.
It does.
And it was originally passed in 2018, and I think it was amended in 2020.
Okay, there you go.
So that, yes. But we'll talk about state court in a hot minute, because we want to finish our federal stuff, because that's something we don't really know about. Y'all are the experts. And, you know, I think one thing we've thrown out around a lot of statutes, and most of our listeners are people who don't practice law. And really, the cases that you guys see in federal court, we see murder, usually gang, so that there's a connection or nexus to interstate commerce. There's racketeering, RICO. There is drugs and, you know, drug conspiracy and child pornography. Would you say that's the bulk of what you see in the felony side as to what they bring over in the Eastern District?
That's probably a good majority of it. I agree.
Yeah, which kind of segues into my question. So in the state courts, we have things like deferred findings where you could have it dismissed. And now we have a new law that's going to go into play in 2025 to petition for sealing of convictions and things like that. Does the federal court... For our listeners out there, if you're convicted in federal court, is that it?
That is it. There's no expungement statute in federal court. You can't get anything expunged or anything along those lines. Actually, and even if you're found not guilty, there's no expungement process.
Well,
unless it's a possession of marijuana case, which statutorily it provides that it can be expunged. But that's the only exception. There's no general expungement statute in federal court. It's definitely a deficiency. No question about that. State court's way ahead and much more appropriate in that regard. Federal court can be harsh. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, Mark's right. There's a statute that allows you to have, it's crazy because you have to be under, 21 years old, and it has to be a marijuana possession, and I can't remember the code section. And then you can get it expunged. It's limited.
That's right.
I really appreciate you guys coming on. Any last words about federal sentencing before we end this segment?
Yeah, don't do the crime.
Don't even be near the crime.
Do the crime.
And if you do, call us.
That exactly. Would be Mark Petrovich and Tom Walsh. Don't call the rest of us because we don't go to federal court.
That's right.
Thanks, guys, for joining.
Peace out.
Guys.
Thanks for joining us on Crime Time. I hope you liked what you heard. And we hope you join us for the next episode.